Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Tonight, Donald Trump's escalation of dangerous rhetoric with a potential indictment looming, predicting death and destruction just hours before the Manhattan DA's office received a threatening letter. Then Marjorie Taylor Greene takes her political theater to a D.C. jail to visit January the 6th defendants. But what were conditions really like? And Florida's culture war takes aim at Michelangelo? How the rallying cry of so-called parents' rights could shape the 2024 election as the 11th hour gets underway on this Friday night. Good evening. I'm Mehdi Hassan in for Stephanie Ruhl. At 1 o'clock this morning, Donald Trump posted yet another insulting and threatening message to his social media platform. He called Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg a, quote, degenerate psychopath, and warned that potential death and destruction could follow a charging decision from Bragg's office in the Stormy Daniels hush money case. At 11:40 this morning, D.A. Bragg's office received an anonymous threatening letter. That letter said, quote, Alvin, I'm going to kill you for this, in all capital letters with 13 exclamation points. The envelope contained white powder, which thankfully was not dangerous. A senior New York law enforcement official says there have been several hundred threats to the DA's office in recent weeks, including a couple of dozen considered directly threatening serious harm to Bragg. Of course, we can't directly link Trump's behavior to these threats, but everyone can see what Trump has been up to lately on social media, and it's disgusting. The Manhattan hush money payments case is, of course, just one of Trump's legal troubles. He's lashing out in all directions. In the classified documents case, key Trump attorney Evan Corcoran appeared before a federal grand jury this morning in Washington, D.C. Corcoran's testimony was ordered by Judge Beryl Howell, who ruled last week that there was sufficient evidence Trump had misled his lawyers about the classified material at Mar-a-Lago. NBC News reports that same judge dealt another blow to Trump in the January 6th probe. Judge Howell denied his claims of executive privilege and ordered Mark Meadows and other top aides to testify before the grand jury. Former FBI counterintelligence agent Peter Strzok explained why that testimony will be so crucial.
While many of these folks have gone before the grand jury, while many of these folks have gone to the January 6th committee, they haven't answered questions about the things that Trump himself said to them or that they said to him. And that, of course, is at the core of every investigator, every prosecutor, every agent wants to know what it was that Trump said. Not what Mark Meadows said to Cassidy Hutchinson, not what John Ratcliffe thought with when he was talking with somebody else on the White House staff, but those individual communications they were having with Trump himself. And that's what this order demands, compels them to provide information-wise to the grand jury.
So expect more late-night unhinged social media posts from Donald Trump, I guess. With all of that, let's bring in our lead-off panel, John Allen, senior national politics reporter for NBC, Amna Nawaz, the co-anchor of PBS NewsHour and an MSNBC contributor, and Barbara McQuaid, a veteran federal prosecutor and former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Thank you all for joining me this Friday night. John, what are you hearing from Trump world about these former aides being compelled to testify?
Well, they're certainly not happy about former aides being compelled to testify. Obviously, Donald Trump's done everything under his power to keep people who worked for him from testifying, whether it's people who are aides to him, like Mark Meadows, or people who have been in his orbit otherwise. This is not something that's comfortable for him. One of the things that my colleagues and I at NBC's, as reporters have been hearing, is that Trump really does not want to be in legal jeopardy, does not want to be arrested. And I think that has something to do with some of this real vitriol you're seeing from him right now.
Bob, from a legal perspective, how important is the testimony from Meadows and others in this case to special counsel Jack Smith?
I think it's critically important. Mark Meadows, as the chief of staff, was there with Trump when all of these discussions were happening about pressuring Mike Pence, about what they were going to say on the ellipse, about what Trump did or did not do during the 187 minutes while the Capitol was under siege. The Willard Hotel war room, he, at the last minute, at the advice of Cassidy Hutchinson, did not attend that meeting, but he did participate by conference call. And so he especially seems well positioned to be able to explain all of the inner workings of Trump and his closest advisors during the run up to January 6th. I think his testimony in particular is critically important to this.
Bob, also the judge rejected these aides' claims of executive privilege. Of course, Mike Pence has argued he's immune from testifying because of legal protections for lawmakers, as we pointed out on the show earlier this week. The Trump team say he's executive privilege. Pence's people say it's congressional. What does this all mean for Pence?
Yeah, I think that executive privilege is not going to hold up. I think we've long known that because of the precedent that was set in United States versus Nixon, which said that executive privilege is only a qualified privilege. And so when there is some greater need, then the privilege must yield. And in Nixon, it was a grand jury investigation that the court said was that greater need. So I don't think executive privilege is going to work for any of these people. The speech or debate clause that you're referring to, a privilege for the legislative branch, is a really novel argument coming from the vice president, who is himself a member of the executive branch most of the time. But on January 6th, and in certain circumstances, he sits as the president of the Senate. And so he says in that capacity, he is entitled to this speech or debate clause privilege. I think at best, that will narrow the scope of maybe certain questions are off limits, maybe not at all. But I don't think he's going to be able to use it to completely block his testimony. I think he is ultimately going to have to testify, and Jack Smith will get out of him what he wants.
Amnon, not only is it difficult to keep track of all of Trump's legal troubles, it's hard to keep track of which of his lawyers now are in legal troubles. We've heard that MAGA now stands for Making Attorneys Get Attorneys. What should we expect to come out of Evan Corcoran's grand jury appearance in D.C. this morning?
Well, here's another person who probably holds some answers to those questions that Peter Strzok was referencing just a couple of minutes ago, which is what exactly did Trump say? We have to remember Evan Corcoran did appear before the grand jury before and basically did not answer any of those questions. There is such a thing as attorney-client privilege. We also know prosecutors have a way of getting around that. And I think some of the answers to those questions might come out from his testimony. But here's what Evan Corcoran might be able to answer, because you have to remember in the special counsel, Jack Smith, probe into the possible mishandling of classified documents down at his Mar-a-Lago estate, it was Evan Corcoran who sent that letter last June to the Department of Justice that basically said, we have conducted a full review. Here are the documents that are pursuant to your subpoena. And that was accompanying about three dozen or so documents. Turned out those were not all the documents. And the FBI had to return with a search warrant and removed about 100 or so additional classified documents or documents with classified markings. And so I think there are obvious questions for Mr. Corcoran about whether he knew there were additional documents, whether he was told there were no additional documents, and whatever the grand members of the grand jury can take away from that. So what you're seeing in all of this is the people who are closest to Mr. Trump, with whom Mr. Trump believes he had confidential or private conversations, they have some of the keys to the answers to these questions.
And Bob, we keep talking about how angry Trump is to be under investigation for all these alleged crimes. But could he be committing any new crimes with all his social media posts this week? If you were a prosecutor looking at Trump, would you be kind of control-essing them? Would you be taking screen grabs of all these posts to use later?
Absolutely. You know, he has said things that I would characterize as stochastic terrorism. That is, just throwing out some anger out there. No particular directive, no orders, but enough that somebody is likely to take the bait. Like this post with him holding a baseball bat next to Alvin Bragg clearly is a suggestion for somebody to harm physically Alvin Bragg. Now, it's subtle and it's not direct. And so in light of First Amendment protections, I think he has plausible deniability as to whether those are true threats. But I would continue to collect them because at some point you may be able to make an argument that he has crossed the line. And I also think that as he continues to do this, there might be an argument, even if it's not a separate charge, but an argument to the judge that ultimately is assigned to this case, that perhaps there ought to be a gag order on this case to prevent Trump from talking about it and creating a circus-like atmosphere. You may recall that Roger Stone was subject to a gag order after he posted on social media a photo of the judge in his case with the rifle crosshairs superimposed on her face. So we might see something similar to that in order to just protect the public from bubbling over.
And we know the judge in the E. Jean Carroll defamation trial this week has said the jurors should remain anonymous there for their own safety. Such is the state of America in 2023. Amina, you have Trump with that baseball bat picture that Barb referenced. He also called Bragg a Soros-backed animal. Today he was calling him a degenerate psychopath. It is the case, is it not, that Trump, who is pretty verbally abusive about anyone who crosses his path, saves his most vitriolic attacks, his most misogynistic and racist attacks, for women and for people of color?
I think it is worth pointing out the simple fact that Alvin Bragg is Manhattan's first black district attorney, and that has been pointed out in much of the reporting, because some of the language that Mr. Trump has used could certainly be seen as racist in this kind of circumstance. But I think the most important thing we have to stress here is that this is rhetoric, this is in some ways typical for Mr. Trump in many ways, but that these kinds of words and this kind of ramping up of violent rhetoric has real-world consequences. We cannot link today's letter necessarily to anything Mr. Trump has said, but this is no longer a hypothetical, and it's not a hypothetical when it comes to this particular individual. January 6th is the perfect example of that, but we also know more broadly we're living in a time of rising political violence, not just in terms of what we saw in the likes of January 6th, but in terms of what people see as acceptable in the way of political violence or towards some kind of political means and ends. And so I think those two things have to be underscored when we're talking about this, that what we're hearing from Mr. Trump, but we're also hearing from Republicans who have also turned their fire towards the Manhattan DA, that kind of language has real-world consequences. And if it wasn't this letter, it wouldn't be surprising to see if it was something else down the line.
John, Amina mentions Republicans, other Republicans. Are you hearing anything from Republicans, even behind the scenes? You know, the cowardly ones who won't say anything publicly, but might text a reporter like yourself to say, this is shocking and disgusting, and I'm totally against all of this. Because as recently as a decade ago, I'm pretty sure if Mitt Romney, while running for president, had referred to a black man as an animal or a psychopath, he would have been forced to stand down from the race. But such is the, you know, such is our current moment that it's acceptable now on the Republican side.
Well, I haven't had a single text or phone call from a Republican operative strategist or elected official saying that they are shocked by what Donald Trump is saying. I mean, for 8 years, he's been doing this. And, you know, in order to get attention at some level, I think he feels he needs to do this. What we have seen, though, is the level of outrage from Republicans has definitely diminished. And we've seen Republicans supporting him in his attacks on Alvin Bragg, not necessarily repeating some of the most, racially charged or racist language, but certainly repeating many of the attacks on Bragg that Trump is throwing out there. So if anything, he has bent the Republican Party, as we know, toward him. And there's really no signs that it's bending away from him yet.
And John, you're in Waco, Texas, where Trump is doing his first rally of 2023 on the anniversary of the Waco siege. Do we know what he's going to say tomorrow, dare I ask?
I don't know what he's going to say, Maddie, but past his prologue, he's going to say a lot of anti-government things. He's going to say things about, what he calls the deep state. He will talk about, his theory that there is a conspiracy to get him among all the Democrats, all the liberals, all the non-Trump Republicans, pretty much everybody that's not his base. I think that will mesh well with, for the most extreme elements of his anti-government base. That said, there are a lot of other reasons to have a rally in Waco if you're a Republican seeking the presidency. Among other things, it's basically accessible from all the four major metropolitan areas, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio, and Austin. So, there are a lot of reasons to do a rally in Texas right now, but it will not be lost on anyone that this is during the 30th anniversary of this siege at the compound run by David Koresh.
And we're going to talk more about that later in the show. But before I wrap up this discussion, Amna, let's talk about the current president, Joe Biden, a trip to Canada today. You've been reporting on that, I know. Let's have a listen to part of what he said.
We're also making good on our commitment to address the historic levels of migration in our hemisphere. Since we created dedicated pathways in the United States, the number of migrants arriving on our southern border has dropped precipitously. And I commend Canada for stepping up with a similar program, opening new legal pathways for up to 15,000 migrants to come to Canada from countries in the Western Hemisphere.
Can Joe Biden get credit, quote unquote, for all the other things he's doing at a time when Donald Trump is back sucking up all the media oxygen, Amna?
I don't know that I can answer that question. What I can say specific to this issue is that this is something that has bedeviled this administration and the previous administration and the one before that, and will likely challenge the next one as well. Immigration remains just one of those things that until there is absolutely complete and total congressional-led some kind of reform, this will continue to be a problem. And we are living at a time of unprecedented migration across the world. So the steps taken by Canada today are not unlike steps taken by the U.S., or not unlike steps taken by a number of other nations, all of whom are seeing an increase of people attempting to cross their borders and seeking protection of some kind, security of some kind, stability of some kind. I will tell you, I spoke with someone on the Canadian side of the border today who said, look, over the last year, they saw some 40,000 people crossing at irregular points of entry, which is a five-year high for them. And so opening up a legal pathway for 15,000, this person said, is basically a drop in the bucket. It's not necessarily a solution, but it's something we're seeing from a number of administrations. And it's something I'll tell you, President Biden, we've seen from this administration, and that immigration advocates are not very happy about.
Yes, indeed. We will have to leave it there. John Allen, Amna Nawaz, and Barbara McQuaid, thank you all for your analysis and for your reporting. Much appreciated on this Friday night. Coming up, Marjorie Taylor Greene, remember her? Led a congressional delegation to a D.C. jail today to look at conditions for January the 6th defendants. But a few Democrats tagged along too. One of them is here for a reality check. And later on the show, it's been 30 years since the standoff near Waco, Texas, that left dozens dead. We'll talk to historian John Meacham about Donald Trump choosing Waco, of all places, to hold a big rally tomorrow, the 11th hour, just getting underway on a Friday night.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Need a cold coffee with a bold flavor? Dunkin' Cold K-Cup Pods were specially crafted for cold coffee. Brew over ice straight out of the Keurig coffee maker for smooth, delicious Dunkin' taste you know and love. Find your next Dunkin' Cold coffee in the roasted coffee aisle.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Now, for 2 years, we've heard the story from the people on the January 6th committee. We've heard the story about how it was an insurrection. And I'm going to tell you something right now. It was not an insurrection. We have to work as hard as possible to defund the two-tiered injustice system. And we have to return freedom and due process rights to these pre-trial January 6th defendants.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene whitewashing the violent riot at the Capitol. This was during a visit to a jail to see the conditions that January 6th defendants are living in. That whistling you heard in the background was from one of the people protesting that trip. Greene has claimed that the defendants are living in atrocious conditions and says she's heard reports of abuse. That's why she wanted to see the jail herself. But two House Democrats joined her on that trip. Joining me now is one of them, Texas Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, who was there for today's visit. Congresswoman, thanks for coming on the show tonight. The other Democrat, your colleague Robert Garcia, who was also on the trip, he said in a statement earlier today that Greene and Congresswoman Lauren Boebert were treating these insurrectionists like they're pseudo-celebrities. Tell us about what you saw. Does it match what Marjorie Taylor Greene has been saying?
No, absolutely not. And let's be clear about what they feel like is problematic treatment, right? They had a lot of questions that were specifically centered around vaccination requirements. Oftentimes, we would hear Boebert actually interject over Marjorie Taylor Greene and asking about, well, were they required to be vaccinated? Did you decide you weren't going to treat people because they weren't vaccinated? Are you forcing people to be vaccinated? Well, why are you testing people for COVID? Like all of these very like crazy questions. Obviously, we've got real doctors in here. They're treating any and everyone. And obviously, COVID, it spreads, right? So it absolutely makes sense that they're giving COVID tests during the intake process. But what was interesting was some of the things that are offered. And anyone who's ever had a loved one that's been incarcerated, they understand that this is not the norm. I mean, I don't know what world Marjorie Taylor Greene and Boebert and the rest of them are living in. But even in the women's area, I've got my notes that I was reviewing. Art therapy, yoga, acupuncture. I mean, these are things that we can't even find like in my district for my people, like that aren't incarcerated, right? They have these tablets that they have access to. They're able to get on these tablets. I asked to see the tablets. I saw the tablets. There's two different types of tablets where they're given access to education. I mean, they went out of their way today to make sure that they provided us with a folder full of all the things that they are offering these January 6 inmates, as well as others. They've got a barber shop. There's all kinds of stuff that I've never seen. And I've been practicing law for almost two decades.
So let me ask you this. You and I think can agree that prison in general in America is not a great place to be. Our prison system is not highly regarded when it comes to how other countries treat people incarcerated. The problem here is not that they're complaining about January 6th defendants. The problem is that I don't remember Marjorie Taylor Greene or Lauren Boebert ever complaining about other people behind bars, especially black and brown people behind bars. Have you ever heard them complain about the conditions of other people in prison, aside from their favorite?
I haven't, and I don't really think that I will. I don't have high hopes that we're going to have a real conversation around where the problems exist. You know, in fact, I will publicly offer to have them come down to my area, come to Texas. Let's see what prison conditions are like in Texas, and then we can have a conversation. I would love to have them come and look to see what is really going on with people that look like me, people that are disproportionately harassed, people that are disproportionately incarcerated, people that are disproportionately losing their lives. We're talking about black and brown people a lot of times don't even make it to the jails. This was simply an opportunity for these Republican members to have off the record conversations, non-recorded, which anybody who's ever had a loved one, they know they get that little recording. This call is being recorded. That didn't happen today. They had free conversations in the recreation area. It seemed like it was it was crazy. But both sides were really excited to see each other. The inmates were really excited to see Marjorie Taylor Greene and crew. And Marjorie Taylor Greene and crew was very excited to see the January 6th inmates. In fact, one of the members said, hey, this is taking too long. I just want to see the inmates. They didn't even really want to do the tour. They just wanted to go see the January 6ers.
So it's interesting. You used the word excited. Your colleague, Congressman Garcia, used the phrase pseudo celebrities. It's interesting that there's this kind of love-in between people who tried to overturn the government and attack police officers and members of the Republican Party. So I have to ask, how is it that your party, the Democratic Party, still runs from the crime issue and the law and order issue, still is always in a defensive posture about we can't look weak on crime and we can't talk about defund the police. We'll get attacked by the Republicans. How on earth is your party still on the defensive when the other party is basically cozying up to insurrectionists in prison?
Listen, I'm a freshman. You know, I am in leadership, but I just got there as far as I'm concerned. Listen, we are the
real
party.
But you take my wider point, though. You get the point I'm making, right?
They're the party of lawlessness. That's what this is. There's nothing more. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is saying, forget your lying eyes. this is essentially what we have seen the entire time that we've seen the Black Lives Matter movement, is people wanting to say, forget your lying eyes, forget what you're seeing right in front of your face. We don't need you to go and give us their version of their story. Basically, all you want to do is promulgate a defense for them. They will have their day in court whenever that day happens. But we all saw what happened, and we know what the reactions were, even from the Republicans, when it happened. So what you're not going to do is rewrite history. I know that the Republicans don't want to talk about history. They don't want to talk about real policing. And they absolutely don't want to talk about the fact that they don't have any plans for anything. They definitely don't have any plans to keep us any safer, because the idea that going and checking on January 6ers, people that really were there, some of them trying to kill your colleagues, you can't tell me that you belong to the party of law and order. We own that space. Yes. We should definitely, like you said, we should scream it from the mountaintops. If you want to be safe, holler at a Democrat.
Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, appreciate you coming on the show today. Thank you.
Absolutely. Have a good one.
Republicans are politicizing the classroom under the guise of quote unquote parental rights. But will these so-called culture wars work at the ballot box in 2024? Let's take that to our political panel when the 11th hour continues. Maybe you've heard Michelangelo's iconic statue, David, has been in the news this week. That's because a Florida charter school principal was forced to resign after a picture of the famously nude statue was shown in class and three parents complained. In an interview with Slate, the school board chair says the issue was the parents weren't notified in advance. He says last year a notice went out to all parents warning them their children would be shown the artistic masterpiece. One of the ways he defended the school, pointing out it's a traditional education based on Western civilization. Yeah. This comes as the Republican-led House just passed the so-called Parental Bill of Rights Act. It would require public school districts to publicly post information about what's being taught, including providing parents with a list of books available at school libraries, something they can already get on their own. With us for more, Robert Gibbs, former Obama campaign senior advisor and White House press secretary under President Obama, and former Republican Congressman David Jolly. He's now chairman of the Serve America movement. He's also an MSNBC political contributor. Thank you both for joining us this Friday night. David, many in your old party, the GOP, seem to think they can ride this parents' rights movement to sweeping victories in 2024. Do you think they're right?
Well, unfortunately, in Republican politics, it's very galvanizing. The culture war movement is real in Republican politics, but I think it depends on how Democrats handle this and how they hit back on it. And I think, importantly, what we're seeing from Michelangelo's David to the Bill of Rights in Congress, we've got to call it out for several things. First and foremost, it's ignorant. It's just raw ignorance, if you take the Michelangelo story. It's fearful, right? They are actually fearful that somehow the schools have greater power than their own parenting skills. Somehow they can't outparent the schools, and so government needs to back them up. But then I also think it, very importantly, it needs to be called out as qualitatively discriminatory. This entire movement about empowering parents is actually trying to protect them from their kids being exposed to diversity, from not just marginalized communities, but very specifically the LGBTQ community. That is qualitatively discriminatory, and that has to be called out. And so rather than accept their argument on their playing field, make them defend why they are discriminating against fellow Americans.
I mean, at least, David, the culture wars are going a little highbrow. They've gone from Mr. Potato Head and the M&M to Michelangelo. At least they've moved. At least
Dr.
their targets
Seuss.
Are moving up
Dr.
in the
Seuss,
in the world. Dr. Seuss is highbrow, though. Robert, here's what House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries said about the bill earlier. Have a listen.
Today, extreme MAGA Republicans passed a bill that puts politics over parents and will ban books, censor librarians, and bully children. It's shameful.
Robert, David just mentioned it all depends what the Democrats do. What should the Democrats be doing right now?
Well, I think what they should be doing is saying exactly what Hakeem Jeffries is saying. Look, if this whole thing about the statue, Michelangelo statue, Mehdi, sounds like it could be the subject of an episode of The Simpsons. It, in fact, was the episode subject of the episode of The Simpsons.
Yes.
To give you a sense of just kind of how outlandish this whole thing is. But let's look at the politics of this. A poll that was done earlier this week of a national electorate tested a few of these concepts, one of which Governor DeSantis is pushing similar to this around having a media specialist approve every book in a library. 36% of the American electorate approved of that, even fewer independents. So this is not an agenda that's focused on even 50% of the country, let alone a broad majority. This is the House pushing a very narrow, very culturally conservative agenda that for their presidential candidates or for some of their base may appeal to. But when you get outside of that base, when you get into swing voters, this is not something that's going to resonate in 2024, not when there are big, serious issues out there. I think worrying about the statue, David, is fairly low on the list of big priorities.
Well, interestingly, CRT didn't resonate in 2022 as they hoped it would, and nor did Dr. Seuss. So you may be onto something there. David, the same party, your old party, that made fun of the idea of snowflakes and safe spaces and extol the value of free speech is now the one banning books in school, banning images, banning this, banning that. How far is this from the party that you were once part of? How quickly has this happened to the GOP?
Yeah, look, it's a party of glass jaws, certainly, and it's a party of snowflakes, if you will. But I think, look, it's a fantastic question. How far away is this from the party that I knew? It's actually not that far. This is an interesting thing. So this is a party that was rooted culturally in white nationalism, white Christian America, anti-LGBTQ. But there was this brief period, frankly, as I was emerging and felt comfortable, where some of those cultural issues the Republican Party went silent on. Even during Bush 43, the compassionate conservative who said, we're not really going to deal with the issue of abortion. And as gay marriage came up, you saw Republicans fight it, but then they fell silent. And it was interesting as I served to see, I thought we were going in the direction of more moderate, at least accommodating more moderate views. But what happened from the Tea Party into Trump is a reflex back to what the party was 30 years ago. And so I don't know that it's that different than what it's always been. And I think this is the danger of Donald Trump. Instead of taking us through Trumpism to who we can be as a country, it's taking us back to who we used to be. And who we used to be was a very discriminatory, dark culture.
Yeah, the make America great again is always the question. When was it great? Which year is it you want to take us back to? Robert, let's talk about 2024. Let's look forward. Politico has a new report out pointing out that Ron DeSantis has had a tough week, backtracking on Ukraine, dipping poll numbers. NBC News is reporting that some big donors are saying, hey, why don't you wait till 2028? Is he ready for the national stage? I for one, have been saying he isn't. What do you think?
Well, I think it has been a tough week for Ron DeSantis, and I think he learned pretty quickly that this isn't spring training. It's not the minor leagues. This is big league baseball. And when you come with the expectations that Ron DeSantis has come with and the early poll numbers, you don't get to practice off Broadway. I think he's had a tough week. The answer with Ukraine sounded, quite frankly, naive, not ready for prime time, certainly not ready to be the commander in chief. He described, the Ukraine conflict as one of a territorial conflict, as if it was two neighbors arguing over where the fence should be in the side yard. That's not somebody that's ready for prime time. I've also been struck, too, by this week, Mehdi, the entire Republican Party has reached to embrace Donald Trump. As he looks to be indicted for what is an illegal payment to a porn star. And I'm not really understanding the strategy of how you're going to beat Donald Trump if the entire party is going to coalesce around him on something that, quite frankly, I think everybody can agree with is untoward. So I think it's been a tough week for the Republican Party. I think it's been a tough week for Ron DeSantis and trying to prove that he's ready. It's probably been a fairly good week for Donald Trump.
Well, we know he's not ready for prime time because he didn't do prime time. He sat down with Piers Morgan for Fox Nation. Robert Gibbs, David Jolly, thank you both. Appreciate it. Coming up, the power of place as Trump amplifies calls for violence. We look at why the location tomorrow for his first campaign rally of 2023 is raising eyebrows. And we have just the guy to put it all into perspective for us. Historian John Meacham is here when the 11th hour continues. This year and this month marks the 30th anniversary of the siege near Waco, Texas. Many of us will remember that deadly standoff between a cult led by David Koresh and federal law enforcement. Decades later, that event is viewed as a symbol of government overreach by some on the far right. So perhaps it's not surprising that Donald Trump has decided to hold his first campaign rally of the year in Waco tomorrow. Trump's campaign told the New York Times the city was chosen because it's centrally located to the biggest metro areas in Texas. But the Times also points out, quote, a polarizing episode in its own time. The deadly raid was invoked in the 1990s by right-wing extremists, including Timothy McVeigh, often to the dismay of the surviving Branch Davidians. It has remained a cause for contemporary far-right groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. You have to think, Trump knows what he's doing here. With us for more, John Meacham, historian and Rogers Chair in the American Presidency at Vanderbilt University. He's also author of And There Was Light, Abraham Lincoln and the American Struggle. John, thanks for coming on the show tonight. Talk to us about the Waco siege and what it's come to symbolize over the years, especially for the far right and people who go on and on about government tyranny.
Well, it became a symbol in real time, right? As you point out, the manifesto, the impetus behind Timothy McVeigh's attack on the Oklahoma City Federal Building in 1995 was timed to the date, the anniversary, April 19th, also Patriots Day, the anniversary of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, in order to express the fury of the right, broadly put, at what was seen as government overreach. If this was the era in which the NRA put out a fundraising letter referring to ATF agents as jackbooted thugs, which led a life member of the NRA, George Herbert Walker Bush, to write a letter resigning from the NRA, saying that it violated his concept of service to country to attack federal agents in that way. And so it's a landmark in the American story of tragedy and terror, and it's solemn. I mean, think of the number of lives lost both in Waco at Ruby Ridge, which was another episode in the 1990s, and then at the Murrah Building. And you just are reminded again, first of all, it's amazing, it's been 30 years. You're reminded again that words matter, that this is not a reality show. This is the real world. And we have to stand vigilant minute to minute, day to day, week to week, year to year, against this kind of extremism.
But don't worry, John. Donald Trump's going to Waco tomorrow to dial down the temperature, is he not?
No. You know, I was struck by the fact that the rally's there and the terrible posts about death and destruction. And I would recommend to folks here, here's a Friday night recommendation for fun. There was an important essay written in 1964 by a historian at Columbia University named Richard Hofstetter. It's called The Paranoid Style in American Politics. Yeah. It was the cover story of Harper's in October 1964, at that point about the John Birch Society. That was the latest manifestation tied somewhat to the Goldwater campaign. Hofstetter's argument is that there's a perennial tendency in American life to see the world in conspiratorial terms, that there is a force that you cannot see, read deep state, that is in control of your destiny. That every moment is a cataclysmic one, that everything requires high drama, everything is existential. And it's an important piece because, A, it reminds us this is a perennial force, and B, because it's a perennial force. It's something that we have to deal with in our own time.
And What's interesting, and the Hofstadter essay has always, for me, defined the Trump campaign, the Trump phenomenon. He's a walking human embodiment of the paranoid style of American politics. But it's not just him, right? He's enabled by an entire Republican infrastructure. And this week, they've all got behind him to attack Alvin Bragg. Jim Jordan, influential committee chair in the House GOP, he refused today to comment on Trump's death and destruction post. My colleague Sahil Kapoor, NBC reporter, showed him the post. He said, oh, I haven't seen the post. When he showed him the post, he said, I haven't got my reading glasses. I feel like we've gone back in time to 2017, 2018, where every Republican said, we haven't seen the tweets. I mean, this is the GOP, which is now just a vehicle for Trump's paranoia and incitement of violence.
It absolutely is. And it, to be quite candid, I quoted Hofstadter at the end of 15 into 16, believing that Trump was the fullest manifestation of the paranoid style, but that it would not endure. He would not rise to the top of the Republican field. I was completely wrong. You are exactly right. There is an enabling machinery now that is really taken one of the two functioning political parties in the United States, a constitutional system that requires two functioning parties, and has taken one out of the mix. And I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I have voted for presidential candidates of both parties and down ballot. But let's be very clear here. The Republican Party, in the grip of Trump, is not a functioning part of the constitutional order. It's just not. And I don't have a partisan enough brain to quite understand how people can decide that, oh, well, you know, the Democrats are going to be too far left, so therefore I'm going to support a party that at least makes insurrection possible and at worst inspires it. But that is the question that my Republican friends, and I live in Tennessee, so when I say I have Republican friends, that's redundant. That's the question I continue to put to them, is do you want to be part of this illiberal order?
It's a question we have to keep asking. I'm not sure they have any answers. John Meacham, thank you so much. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Coming up, a third grader picked this woman, pilot Bessie Coleman, as her hero. And when a teacher said no, she did just what her hero did. She proved them wrong. That's when the 11th hour continues.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
The last thing before we go tonight, never take no for an answer. Have you heard of Bessie Coleman? If not, in 1921, she was the first African-American and Native American person to earn an international pilot's license, something even famed female aviator Amelia Earhart didn't receive until 1923. And Coleman was the first black woman to fly in the U.S. After she accomplished all that, Coleman made it her mission to inspire women and black Americans to go after what they want, like she did. And to this day, she is. Our own Yamiche Alcindor has the story.
9-year-old Alex Williams got an assignment for Black History Month. Describe a hero. She chose Bessie Coleman, the first African-American woman to earn a pilot's license in the United States.
She flew in the sky and she got to do everything that she wanted, because even though everybody was like, no, you can't do that, you're a girl and you're black, you can't do that.
But her third grade teacher told her Coleman, nicknamed Brave Bessie, was not a hero.
I was mad because I took all that work and my mom, she already got the board.
Alex's mother, who works at the FAA, pushed back.
That's when I switched into mommy bear mode and said, wait a minute. And so I grabbed my phone and I emailed her, and she in turn did say to me, no, she can't do her. She's not a hero. And I was like, I beg to differ.
But she said the teacher suggested more well-known figures like Harriet Tubman or Maya Angelou. And when it came time to present, Alex was not called on.
She cried. She was very upset.
Her mom decided to take her to FAA headquarters, where she detailed Coleman's life to agency officials, including the deputy administrator.
Bessie Coleman was known as Queen Bess, Brave Bess. Bessie Coleman would walk on the wings of airplanes and parachute out.
Alex was also presented with a copy of a newly minted coin commemorating Coleman, along with a Coleman Barbie doll.
What's the lesson for you, Alex?
Not to take no for an answer, because there's a big, gigantic yes at the end of the road.
Yemi Shalcendor, NBC News, Washington.
Brave Bessie's legacy to take us off the air on this Friday night. And on that note, I wish you a good Friday night. I'm Mehdi Hassan, in for Stephanie Ruhle, who will be back Monday. Remember, you can watch The Mehdi Hassan Show, Sundays, 8 p.m. Eastern, right here on MSNBC. From all of our colleagues across the networks of NBC News, thank you for staying up late. See you this weekend.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.